gentlemen. Our first case for this morning will be Appert against Morgan Stanley Dean Witter. And Mr. Lanceman.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Larry Lanceman. I represent Susan Appert, the plaintiff. The issue that we presented before this court is whether, for an expense item that is specifically listed in Morgan Stanley's contract, can defendant charge a fee that is not reasonably related to and is grossly disproportionate to the costs underlying those expense items. We believe that Morgan Stanley has breached the provision in the contract that provides for this fee in two ways. One, the fee itself, the provision is ambiguous in the way it was drafted, and as a result, it has to be construed against the interests of Morgan Stanley. And two, under New York law, because the fee is grossly disproportionate to the expenses usually incurred by financial institutions in the community, it constitutes a breach of contract.
Mr. Lanceman, if we reach the merits of this case, and I don't know if we will, but if we reach the merits, under your theory, does the contract allow for any overhead for Morgan Stanley on those fees?
On these fees, as long as it is reasonably related.
But where is Morgan Stanley promising the kind of proportionality or reasonable relationship for such tiny fees, $2.35 or $5.25, whatever, usually at these very low levels, as Judge Hamilton is saying, there's overhead, people just ballpark an amount. Where have they promised to act otherwise?
By incorporating New York law into their contract, because under New York law, the Jacobs versus Citibank case relates to these type of fees. These are not hundreds of dollars.
So the contract requires us to decide, or a court to decide, whether the overhead and profit on this item are reasonable?
Not exactly. What the contract requires is for the court to ultimately decide, or for the trier of fact to decide, whether the fee that is charged is grossly disproportionate, whether it's for profit or anything else.
This sounds an awful lot like asking what the medieval just price is, line by line in a contract.
Well, that's what the court did below was say that nobody could look at this contract provision and say, it's not reasonable to say that the fee is the actual cost or less than the actual cost, but it has to be reasonably related. In this situation,
how on earth would you decide? That's true at all. It's like you want the courts to be the board of price control that the old Soviet Union had for every single item. Maybe, you know, a dollar, in your view, might have been enough profit if you think it was a 42. I mean, how do we do that?
Well, that's a trier of fact that has to make the decision whether a 90%
percent
of the fee.
Juries to set prices for, you know, wedding flowers, for haircuts, for fees like this.
Where there is a contractual provision that says we're going to charge $235 for a specific expense item, there has to be a connection between that expense item, whether it's $235, $5, or $100. There should be
a willing buyer, willing seller. Here it is, $2.35 per transaction for this handling, postage, and insurance. And if people are willing to contract with Morgan Stanley for that amount, then that's their business.
If Morgan Stanley put in the contract that there was a $2.35 per transaction fee period, that would be okay. They could do that.
But
by connecting it.
The less they say, the better.
Pardon me?
If they describe it as postage, handling, and insurance, by bringing that information in, that's harmful to their position?
Well, they are now connecting that fee to that chart, to that expense item. So, yes, they have an obligation at that point to abide by the term of the contract, which is the fee is going to be related to that expense item. If they just.
On a reasonable basis, not grossly disproportionate.
Not grossly disproportionate.
Let's talk a little bit, if we could, Mr. Lanceman, about the jurisdiction that brings this case into federal court. Suppose the contract had said The postage handling and insurance fee is $5 per transaction, which bears no relationship to our costs for providing the service. Would you still have a claim for breach of contract?
Under New York law, yes.
Why?
Because I think under New York law, where the price, I think under Jacobs, where that price is not reasonably related, where it is grossly disproportionate, and they have the discretion to set that fee, they breach the terms of the contract. And I think that's...
Okay. Has any New York court ever actually adopted and awarded relief on that theory?
The only case that we have found that deals with that as an issue is the Jacobs case, and it doesn't get to the actual merits.
You've said many places in your brief that, in essence, if the contract said something like I just read to you, then there would not be a claim. That if that's what Morgan Stanley meant, they should have said so in their contract. Okay. That sounds an awful lot like you're alleging a material omission, which takes us a long way towards SLUSA jurisdiction and preemption. Why is that not correct?
Because under the construct that Your Honor provided, I think that's not the construct that we were referring to in our brief.
You weren't trying to plead securities fraud, but
right.
You are, it seems to me, pleading a theory that depends upon material omission.
I think any breach of contract has the potential to be interpreted in a way that it's an omission. If Morgan Stanley had contracted to provide 50 widgets and didn't provide us with any widgets, then it could be interpreted as saying they misrepresented that they were going to give us those widgets. So I think any type of breach of contract can categorized in some way as a misrepresentation. That's not the situation here, because in the way that Your Honor gave the example, the way that we look at it is that if instead Morgan Stanley had just said $235 for a transaction, and that's it, they didn't tie it to anything, there was no condition to it, it's just going to be $2.35 per transaction, then there would be no reason for us to be here. But in terms of the misrepresentation matter under SLUSA, under New York law, because it's an ambiguous term and because of the gross disproportionality between the charge and the expense, that makes it a breach of contract.
So I understand that you're trying to say every breach of contract isn't fraud, and this is a line that's well understood. I mean, clearly we would have a nightmarish legal system, and I'm actually not at all certain that that's the rule that Morgan Stanley wants either, because they'd have quite a few 10b-5 cases that they don't now face in respecting the difference. But you keep insisting that this contract is ambiguous, and I've looked at these contracts appended to your brief, and I can't find the slightest ambiguity in them. They say it's going to be $235 per transaction. They say fees are subject to change. You will be notified. The clients were notified. Trying to find ambiguity in that is quite an exercise.
If I may, the clause is ambiguous, really for a couple of reasons. One, when you take a look at the actual language, it says...
staring at it.
Right, miscellaneous account fees and charges, including handling, postage, and insurance at $235 a transaction. The language of the contract doesn't say anything about a confirmation slip. It just says $235 per transaction. So you actually have to interpret this to try to understand what is it exactly that they're talking about. And that's what we did in the complaint.
But the point of this is the money. And,
right.
And they get charged during the relevant period of time $235 a transaction, while that happens to be the fee until it gets changed. And, you know, I suppose it's possible with any contract to expand a simple paragraph into a page or two, but this seems absolutely straightforward to me. It reminds me of statements I get from my bank every so often saying it's going to be this much for insufficient funds, and it's going to be that much for wire transfers, and it's going to be that much for whatever other services. And frankly, I sometimes think they're a little pricey too, but you know, it's easy for these institutions to set a fixed price.
It is ambiguous because there are two reasonable interpretations as to what that means. The reasonable interpretation that's been offered by Morgan Stanley is that their interpretation is no reasonable person would look at this and assume that that fee is the actual costs or less than the expense handling postage and
they
insurance.
They wouldn't even go down that line of thinking. They would just say this is a $2.35 or, again, at the relevant time, $5, five and a quarter charge. And you're saying that somebody is going to look at this and read into this language some sort of representation by Morgan Stanley that it costs $2.35 a transaction. Now, maybe it did by the time you factor in, you know, the entire overhead structure that a company like Morgan Stanley or any other company may have. It's very costly to work those expenses down to individual items. As anybody knows who's tried to work through predatory pricing cases in antitrust or anything else. So just picking a number, and I know you have that email where they say, oh, isn't this great? This is all profit. But it isn't. I mean, everybody earns profits. There's nothing necessarily nasty about a profit.
No, and we're not arguing that there is. What we're saying is looking at that provision, I think a person looking at that provision, the only way somebody looking at that provision is going to say, I'm being charged for an expense that they are incurring.
But why are they going to think that the cost, when I go buy a product or a service, I assume that the seller of that product or service has built-in profit for themselves. You know, that's the kind of economy we live in. And so when I see $2.35 a transaction, I don't know whether it's a 42-cent transaction with the rest of it being profit or whether it's a $2 transaction with 35 cents being profit. I make no assumptions whatsoever. I don't know why anybody else would.
There is one assumption that you would make. And the assumption that you would make is that for that $2.35, I am getting handling, I am getting postage, and I am getting insurance.
But see, you're assuming that the insurance is for the benefit of the customer. I'm not sure that's true.
It doesn't matter who it's for.
Maybe Morgan Stanley was self-insuring. Well, you said I'm getting, and so maybe Morgan Stanley chose to forego insurance, self-insure. That's, again, a hidden cost. You are free to use your time now or in rebuttal.
I may just answer that question very quickly. As alleged in the complaint, there is no insurance. Whether it's self-insurance or any other insurance, there is simply no insurance.
Well, that's not the concept of self-insurance. It means you haven't gone out and bought a product. But anyway, we can continue.
If I could follow up on a couple of additional matters. Mr. Landsman, your brief is filed under seal in this case?
Yes.
Why is that?
There was an order in the court below that the attachments to the complaint was not to be... public.
Is there any reason we should keep that seal in place?
I do not believe so. I don't think that it is necessarily.
We unsealed it at some point. Is that not correct? Either side?
I can't see.
Morgan Stanley people.
We'll ask them, but I can't see any reason to keep it unsealed. Second question, would you agree that the agreement here provides for some fees that are identified specifically as pass-through fees?
Yes.
And should we draw any inference from the fact that these others are not, that the fees you're challenging are not identified as pass-through fees?
I think they are identified as miscellaneous account fees, and they are identified, and this one in particular has a specific expense that's assigned to it. So whether it's a pass-through and it has to be the exact amount or whether it has to be just sort of related to that, I think either way.
This sounds, frankly, this reminds me of accounting from setting utility rates, where you do the line by line. That's not really the way our system of economy works, is it?
No, but it is the way that we're supposed to, when they're sending a confirmation, and there's a charge that's associated with this. Like, for instance, if they had there's postage for each one. And let's say they put five of these confirmations into a single envelope. Well, now they're getting extra postage for it. We're not saying that they have to recalculate that depending on the number of confirmations.
Why not? Under your theory, wouldn't that be a terrible fraud?
It wouldn't be a fraud. It could be a breach of contract, but that's where it comes into whether it's grossly disproportionate or not. In this situation, it's not. It is grossly disproportionate.
Let me ask you just one other question here. In dealing with the SLUSA issues, you've argued that your claim does not concern anything material.
It is not a misrepresentation of a material fact.
Well,
price of the security is what you're trying to say. Material to what?
Material to the price of the security, material to the decision whether to purchase or sell the security.
What about material whether to do business with Morgan Stanley?
I don't think it's material for that either. I think that under
so if I got this straight, I'm trying to understand. I've never heard a plaintiff say that what the defendant did wrong is immaterial before.
May I?
Please.
It is a provision of the contract, and it is not material to the decision to buy or sell, but any company, Morgan Stanley, can't breach a term of the contract that provides for a particular charge. And I think in that sense, it's material. There's a difference between a material fact and a material provision of the contract. I think it's a material provision of the contract. It's just not a fact that's material to any decision that happens pursuant to the exercise
of
the party's relationship.
It's not material to your decision whether to do business with the company?
It is not material to the decision whether to enter the contract or not, but it is a material representation. It's a material term of that contract. Once you've made a decision to enter into the contract with Morgan Stanley, it now becomes a part of the relationship and what governs the relationship. And I think in that sense, it is material. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll now hear from Mr. Lewitis.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court. My name is Bruce Lewitis. I serve as in-house counsel for Morgan Stanley. I have to applaud plaintiffs' efforts at using Jacob as a sword in this case because I believe it's absolutely fatal to the breach of contract claim that's before this court. Jacob's court addressed two different fees, one of which is absolutely indistinguishable from the fee at issue in this matter. And it was so simple that the court disposed of it in all of three sentences. The court says the plaintiffs agreed to pay a specified charge pursuant to for certain services. The plaintiffs agreed that those fees would be subject to change. And in as much as plaintiffs do not complain that they were not given notice of subsequent changes, they can't be heard to have breached the contract.
So let me ask you on this contract breach point. The language of this contract does say miscellaneous account fees, including handling, postage, and insurance, the original one, $235 per transaction. So I want to know why a contract wouldn't be breached if those weren't the things being done. If you had a contract that said, we're going to sell you a dog, and instead you delivered a cat, somebody would say that was a breach of contract. You promised a dog, you gave a cat. Some people hate cats for reasons I don't understand. But you've said here handling postage and insurance, and if you didn't include that, then why isn't that a breach?
Well, the way the New York courts have no patience for these types of
No, I'm claims. Asking you a simple question. I'm asking you if you said we're going to give you handling postage and insurance or we're going to charge you $235 because there are three things that are going on here that are expenses to us, and there are really only two. Why isn't that, at a minimum, a breach?
Well,
Do you get to say we're going to charge you $235 per transaction for postage and then email it all? Or I mean, what are you? How much honesty does there have to be between the item that you're charging for and what you're really doing?
In Strategic Risk versus FedEx, a copy of which I submitted to the court yesterday, we had that exact situation, and the New York court found that even though FedEx
but
was
– you can lie about what you're doing and charge money for it, and it's fine in your view.
I am not suggesting that that's the case, but
well,
according
but
to the
that's what I'm trying to get at. What – just in terms of the sheer contractual level, if you say I'm going to do X and you do not X, or you do Y, is there any breach of contract theory? I should think yes. I mean, going way back to the common law, I'm giving you a healthy horse, and you, in fact, give somebody a horse that's disease-ridden, that's a breach of contract.
The crux of the agreement was you're going to pay us $235 for us to deliver and handle your confirmation. That's what plaintiffs have alleged over and over again.
So where's the insurance?
Well, first of all, it's merely an allegation that there was no insurance provided. I understand.
But
we have to take that to be true.
But we are at the 12B6 stage.
I understand.
So don't fight it.
I didn't intend to. It's simply not recognized under New York law that when you lump a bunch of services together and one of them is not provided, it's not actionable. That's what Strategic Risk versus FedEx said.
I think you may be over-reading that.
I confess that I haven't seen that yet. It hasn't hit my desk.
Okay, I filed a 28-J letter yesterday. When I was getting in the weeds on the case, I realized that in plaintiff's reply brief, they were focusing substantially more on the failure to provide insurance that they had previously. Strategic Risk involved a situation where FedEx had a customer agreement with their clients that said, the delivery of your packages include an excise tax. That excise tax lapsed. So the IRS stopped charging FedEx that excise tax. And FedEx failed to amend its customer agreement accordingly. And the court held that since defendant did not separately break out and charge plaintiff for the lapsed federal excise tax, but rather for transporting packages with an all-inclusive charge, there's no breach of contract. And that just goes to show.
Okay, but that's not what you've done here, because you all have broken things out into different line items.
The postage handling and insurance were lumped into one fee, just as the delivery fee and excise tax.
Why isn't that a promise to provide? This is different from a charge. Why isn't that reasonably interpreted as a promise to provide insurance?
I can't dispute that a customer might anticipate that insurance would be provided.
Isn't that the only objective way to read that?
Right, but as Judge Wood pointed out, who's the insurance for? Right? Is it for the benefit of the client, or is it for the benefit of Morgan Stanley? If it's the latter, I submit that we're entitled to self-insure, as you were making the point earlier.
Is that what's happening? Remember, it's 12B6.
Well, since it's 12B6, no insurance was provided.
Okay. Let me ask you, if I could, about the basis for our jurisdiction here. You originally invoked CAFA and or SLUSA.
Correct.
Right? Okay. With SLUSA, I have some question about your attempt to distinguish the Feynman case, since materiality is an essential element for SLUSA jurisdiction.
And just in case you're interested, I have the same question about Feynman. So.
Okay. First of all, Feynman was not a SLUSA case, and in fact, it was decided before SLUSA was even enacted. It was a 10b-5 case.
But obviously,
statute.
Securities, SLUSA and their other securities laws are supposed to work together here. Right?
I appreciate
that. Are you saying
that
we've got different standards of materiality for SLUSA and for Rule 10b-5 and Section 10b?
I am saying that SLUSA was enacted for the purpose of avoiding this exact type of situation.
Not necessarily.
But it's to be, and DABIT.
It does not mean that you simply get to dismiss any cases you don't like. Are you suggesting there is a different meaning of materiality under SLUSA and under Section 10B of the Exchange Act?
No, I am not.
Okay. So I believe you told us in your brief that we should distinguish Feynman because the amounts involved in that case were so much lower, right? That's what you told
me. I suggested that was one possibility.
Well, that was the low end. In fact, the Judge Newman's opinion for the Second Circuit tells us that the fees involved there were as high as $485 15 years ago, which sounds a lot like $5 today. So that distinction really doesn't work very well.
Well, Fineman may, in fact, hurt Morgan Stanley's SLUSA argument, but it definitely helps Morgan Stanley's breach of contract argument. Because the Fineman court said specifically.
We first have to worry about jurisdiction here, okay? If you don't have materiality, you don't have SLUSA jurisdiction.
Which brings us to CAFA jurisdiction.
Okay, now CAFA jurisdiction has this big exception for a class action that solely involves a claim concerning a covered security, right?
Yes.
Okay, how do you avoid that exception? Since you've told all your SLUSA argument is this is all about misrepresentations and omissions involving purchases and sales of covered securities and in connection with security sales and purchases.
Okay, what was the question regarding CAFA? I'm sorry.
Okay, your SLUSA theory is that these fees are all imposed in connection with the purchase and sale of securities, right?
Yes.
I agree with that. You're also saying it involves misrepresentations or omissions, and we've got this issue about materiality, but that's your theory under SLUSA. Okay. Now, why doesn't the CAFA exception for class actions that solely involve a claim concerning a covered security, why doesn't that exception bar CAFA jurisdiction here?
Is it a covered security? Because this is multiple covered securities.
Is that your theory?
I have to confess, that was not at issue before.
Mr. Luitas, this is your jurisdiction. You invoked the federal court's jurisdiction. We've got the Second Circuit that says not material, which puts your SLUSA theory in deep trouble. And then we've got a CAFA exception that is supposed to work somehow with SLUSA, but uses somewhat different language. And if CAFA doesn't apply, we ought to just send this case back to state court.
Assuming that the court is not going to find that the breach of contract claim is
We don't get to breach of contract until we decide jurisdiction.
Jurisdiction was not raised as an issue.
But, of course, you know that doesn't matter.
Of course I know that.
I hope.
All I can say is
Did you plead diversity jurisdiction?
What's that?
Did you plead diversity jurisdiction?
Yes, minimal diversity and over $5 million.
Yeah. How about real diversity? How about 1332 diversity?
I don't believe that we pled that.
They don't have it. It's CAFA or SLUSA.
Well, you've said the named plaintiff is a citizen of Illinois, and defendant Morgan Stanley Incorporated in Delaware, principal place of business in New York. But you'd have an amount of controversy issue.
Right.
Your theories here bump into each other and in difficult ways, because actually I think Fineman is a big problem for SLUSA. One wouldn't even need to reach the question whether in connection with was satisfied if, in fact, materiality is lacking. And I haven't found any case, we looked pretty hard, in which this kind of brokerage fee was material in the sense that Fineman says securities transactions are material. The only thing you can say about the fee is it might operate as a disincentive for people to trade, because people might say, man, you know, every time we trade some stock with Morgan Stanley, they hit us with these huge fees, so maybe we should leave Morgan Stanley, or maybe we shouldn't trade as much. If the fee were $50 per transaction, they would trade even less, I assume. So there's going to be some effect on amount of trading, but no effect on the external stocks.
Well, I mean, incrementally, it's going to impact the value.
Why? Why is Morgan Stanley's trading in Boeing shares going to have the slightest to do with what Boeing is going for in the market?
Well, I think that that's reading the in connection with requirement a little more strictly than the courts have
not
have
more
read.
Strictly than Fineman reads it. Fineman says, here's this little fee. It's not going to. And then our decision in Gavin is actually quite similar. Our decision says, in connection efforts to manipulate the price of securities, failure to make full disclosures of material facts, other things that affect the security price.
Well, I think Gavin is extremely distinguishable. This under Dabit, it's sufficient that the issue coincide with the securities transaction. And then I think it was in Siegel.
So somebody
Siegel
had lunch, you know, while they were chatting with their broker. That's in connection with the purchase or sale of a security?
Well, this isn't just coinciding. This is dependent on a transaction. If there's no transaction, this fee is not imposed.
You pay the electric bill, too, and that's not in connection with your trading activities, although it's necessary for Morgan Stanley's brokers, I presume, to have electricity running.
Well, with all due respect, we don't pay a certain charge for electricity each time a trade is made. In this case, the fee is only charged if a trade is made. If a trade is not made, it's not charged.
But that's your fee. I mean, it's really, I guess, getting at this. It's why the question really is, are things like these brokerage fees, the kinds of things that the securities laws are talking about when they speak of in connection with the purchase or sale of a security, or are they talking about things that affect the securities markets?
The Hansen Court in California just concluded very simply, the mere fact that it relates to the postage and handling fee associated with a trade means it's covered by SLUSA.
Okay. So that's a district court decision. They're entitled to their view. But
Judge Kaur cited a number of decisions that related to fee-based claims that were encompassed by SLUSA or preempted by SLUSA.
Not very much from the courts of appeals, though, other than, like Gavin.
Gavin has very little to do with this case. Gavin, the transaction at issue took place months and months earlier. This related to a third party vendor that they hired to clean up the merger.
Yeah, I remember.
I imagine you do. but the securities transaction that the plaintiffs relied on in that case had taken place months and months prior to the activity that was being complained about. That's not the situation with the case at bar.
Okay, well, if you'd like to just sum up, I'm going to give you another 2 minutes because we asked you a lot of questions, but you're getting a little bit of extra as well.
I think we've covered everything, so thank you.
Well, thank you very much then. So 2 minutes for Mr. Landsman.
Thank you. Just a couple of points. When Mr. Lewittis was arguing about the in connection, I think it's worth pointing out, in the Feynman case, there was an in-connection argument made there as well. That was a case that was against the same defendant. And in that case, this defendant argued that the fee was not in connection with the purchase or sale of a security. In that case, this defendant argued that instead the fee related to the delivery of confirmation slips. So that is the position that they have taken.
The Second Circuit didn't address that.
And they didn't address that.
Yeah.
With regard to the point that Mr. Lewittis was making regarding Jacobs, the one thing that we didn't see in their brief, and the one thing that I didn't hear today, is why he tried to create this distinction in the timing of the setting of the fee under Jacobs. And the thing that they haven't addressed is why the timing makes a difference. If assuming a $5 charge is grossly disproportionate to the actual cost of the underlying expense item, what's the difference if they decide it in advance or if they set that fee on a case-by-case basis? The fact of the matter is it's grossly disproportionate. And even the distinction that they raise, even in their own brief, they're not certain that that's the distinction that the court actually drew in Feynman, because what they say in their brief is it appears to be what the court did. That is by no means clear that the court in Jacobs made that distinction. And the fact is there is no – it's an arbitrary decision, I think, argument to say, well, just because they make that decision before the expense or afterwards on a case-by-case basis.
Well, is a matter of contract law. There is a big difference between parties agreeing in advance what the price will be and You know, sometimes a contract is made without an agreement as to price, and sometimes the courts will simply, in the right circumstances, infer that the parties meant, well, the market price, if that's what we have. So why doesn't that kind of distinction make a difference here?
Because in this contract, they expressly retained discretion to set that fee. So what
they didn't retain discretion to raise the fee after the transaction.
They retained the discretion to set the fee. They could set the fee under the contract, and that's the key distinction here, because they were able to say on their own that we're gonna create this. So it's not market. The Ms. Appert and anybody who entered into the contract agreed in advance that they had that discretion, and that's the difference.
Oh, and they also retained, their customers retained the discretion to leave, right?
Yes.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel. We will take the case under advisement.